Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is January 25th. Welcome to episode 25. Yesterday, we watched the panic caused by Shay's rebellion. The rope of sand had snapped. Everyone, from the wealthy merchants in Boston to the planters in Virginia, knew the Articles of Confederation were failing.
So, the Continental Congress reluctantly admitted defeat. In February 1787, they issued a call for a convention. They invited all 13 states to send delegates to Philadelphia in May.
But, and this is very important, their instructions were extremely specific. They were told only to revise the Articles of Confederation. They were not told to create a new government. They were basically hired to fix a leaky roof, not to tear down the house and build a mansion.
But one man had other ideas. James Madison.
Madison is the unlikely hero of this story. If you saw him on the street, you wouldn't think founding father. You'd think librarian. He was 36 years old. He was incredibly short, only about 5'4". He weighed about 100 pounds soaking wet. He was sickly, hypochondriac, and painfully shy.
He wore black clothes, spoke in a quiet voice, and hated public speaking. But inside that small head was the biggest brain in America.
Madison arrived in Philadelphia on May 3rd, 11 days early. While other delegates were drinking in taverns or shopping, Madison was in his boarding house room, studying.
He had spent months preparing for this. He had Thomas Jefferson ship him crates of books from Paris. He studied the history of every republic that had ever existed. Ancient Rome, Greece, the Swiss Confederacy, the Dutch Republic. He wrote a paper titled, Vices of the Political System of the United States.
He realized that history taught one lesson. Confederacies, leagues of independent states, always fail. They either fall apart into anarchy, or they get conquered by a neighbor. He knew that revising the articles wouldn't work. They had to be scrapped.
But Madison knew he couldn't do it alone. He needed a heavyweight. He needed the one man who could make the convention legitimate just by showing up.
He needed George Washington.
Washington really didn't want to come. He was 55 years old. He had rheumatism. He had just buried his favorite brother. He had promised the world he was retired. He was worried that, if the convention failed, his reputation would be ruined.
But Madison and Henry Knox worked on him. They told him, General, the country is collapsing. If you don't come, we are lost. Finally, reluctantly, Washington agreed.
His arrival in Philadelphia on May 13th was like a rock concert. As he crossed the Schuylkill River, the bells of the city started ringing. A troop of cavalry rode out to escort him. Crowds lined the streets cheering, Huzzah for General Washington!
His presence changed everything. It told the country, this is serious.
And then there was the local celebrity, Benjamin Franklin.
Franklin was 81 years old. He was the most famous man in the world. But he was suffering terribly from gout and kidney stones. He couldn't walk more than a few steps.
So he traveled around Philadelphia in a custom-made sedan chair, basically a box with glass windows carried on poles by four large men. These men were actually convicts from the local jail.
Imagine the scene. The elderly sage of the Revolution, bobbing along the cobblestones in a glass box carried by prisoners.
By May 25th, enough delegates had finally arrived to start the meeting. They gathered in the Pennsylvania State House, now called Independence Hall. It was the same room where they had signed the Declaration of Independence 11 years earlier.
The first order of business was to elect a president of the convention. It was unanimous. George Washington.
Washington was escorted to the front of the room. He sat in a high-backed wooden chair on a raised platform. He didn't participate in the debates. He sat there, silent and imposing, like a judge. But his silence was powerful. Every delegate knew that whatever government they built, Washington would likely be its first leader.
Then, the delegates made a controversial decision. They voted on the rules. And the most important rule was rule number one, secrecy.
They voted that nothing spoken in the House be printed or otherwise published or communicated.
This wasn't just keep it quiet. This was a total blackout. They posted sentries at the doors.
The city of Philadelphia even spread fresh dirt over the cobblestones on Chestnut Street outside, so the noise of passing carriages wouldn't disturb them, and so eavesdroppers couldn't sneak up to the windows.
And despite the legendary Philadelphia summer heat, and it was a boiling hot summer, they kept the windows nailed shut.
Imagine that room. 55 men in wool coats, wigs, and linen shirts. No air conditioning. Windows shut. Flies buzzing everywhere. The smell of sweat and tobacco smoke must have been overpowering.
Why did they do this? Why the secrecy?
It wasn't a conspiracy. It was to allow them to change their minds. Madison said later that if the debates had been public, the delegates would have been afraid to compromise. They would have been playing to the newspapers back home.
Secrecy allowed them to argue, make mistakes, and flip-flop without being called hypocrites. It allowed them to think out loud.
There is a great story about how seriously Washington took this secrecy. One day, a delegate dropped a piece of paper on the floor. It contained his notes on the secret army numbers.
Another delegate found it and gave it to Washington. Washington put it in his pocket and said nothing. At the end of the day, as the men were leaving, Washington stood up. He was furious.
He threw the paper onto the table and said, "I know not whose member's paper this is, but let him take it."
He scolded them like schoolboys. He said, "I must entreat gentlemen to be more careful, lest our transactions get into the newspapers and disturb the public repose."
He bowed and walked out. The room was terrified. No one dared to claim the paper. That is the power of George Washington.
Once the doors were locked, the real work began, and Madison wasted no time.
On May 29th, the Virginia delegation made their move. Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia, stood up. He was tall, handsome, and had a booming voice, the opposite of Madison.
He presented the Virginia Plan. This was Madison's brainchild.
It was a bombshell. It didn't propose fixing the Articles. It proposed a brand new national government.
It called for three separate branches: legislative Congress, executive President, and judicial courts.
And crucially, it proposed a bicameral Congress, two houses, where representation was based on population.
This meant that big states like Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts would have way more votes than small states like Delaware and New Jersey.
The small states panicked. They saw this as a hostile takeover. They had come to Philadelphia to strengthen the Union, not to be swallowed up by a Virginia superstate.
They argued that under the Articles, every state was equal. Delaware had one vote, Virginia had one vote. That was fair. Why should Virginia get 10 votes just because they had more people?
The debate got ugly fast. Gunning Bedford of Delaware stood up. He was a very large, corpulent man, and he shouted at the big state delegates.
He said, "I do not, gentlemen, trust you."
And then he dropped the nuclear threat. He said that if the small states were crushed, they would, quote, "find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith, who will take them by the hand and do them justice."
Think about that. He was threatening that Delaware would leave the United States and join France or Spain, rather than be ruled by the big states.
The convention was on the brink of collapse in the first few weeks. The weather got hotter. The tempers got shorter. Washington sat in his chair, his face grim, wondering if the whole thing was a mistake.
They were deadlocked. The big states refused to yield on population. The small states refused to yield on equality.
They needed a miracle. Or at least, a very clever compromise.
Join us tomorrow for episode 26. The battle lines are drawn. We see how a handful of practical men from Connecticut, Roger Sherman and Oliver Ellsworth, stepped into the breach and saved the Constitution with the Great Compromise.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Stephen. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story.